This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The U.S. justice system is meant to protect Americans from wrongdoing and hold accountable those who would harm others. But advocates for reform point to incidents like the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner as just a few examples of a broken system. We have designed an adversarial system that ultimately relies on violence to enforce compliance. Maybe that's the only way. We live in a dangerous world, after all. But criminologist Michael DeValve argues there is another way, and he dares to suggest that at the center of that way is love. His new book is a meditation on our philosophical understanding of love and the flaws in our criminal justice system and how we might build a new one. It's called A Different Justice, Love and the Future of Criminal Justice in America. Michael DeValve teaches at Fayetteville State University and joins me on the State of Things. Welcome, Michael. Good to have you here.
It's great to be here, Frank. Thank you.
How did you arrive at this idea that there's something that, you know, what's love got to do with it when it comes to criminal justice, right?
Right. As the book talks about the kind of the selfless, skilled, conditionless, and unending service that we would need to provide to really everybody, the victims, offenders, staff people, right, alike. It's about unity. It's about courage. It's a practice. As Eric Fromm talks about the idea in his wonderful work, The Art of Loving, which, by the way, if anyone hasn't picked up, it needs to be read several times. It's a beautiful, beautiful work. He talks about it as an art, and it is. It's a thing like learning how to play the oboe, you know. And goodness knows, playing the oboe badly is really not a pretty thing. But it takes practice and dedication, and all these things are things that we don't think of as part of love. You know, love, as Fromm makes the point, you know, we generally think of love as kind of the emotional kind of gushy cheek shine that we get when we think of a large eyed baby or the first blush of new romance.
Yeah, it's sentiment. It's a sentiment. Yeah. It's a thing that I feel about you. It's
right.
A feeling in me about you. But love in its deepest sense, as you talk about in the book, and you explore many definitions and ideas that are part of the perennial wisdom. It goes back a long time. People have been asking this question. A kind of love that finds my identity in you so that it's not easy. It's not hard for me to love you as myself because you are myself.
Right.
I mean, that's the essential. So what it really means is not sort of exploring the sentiment according to the way you've written about it, but exploring the fact of our identity, and that's the revolutionary part of this, the hard part.
Right, our fundamental connection, our oneness, our interbeing, if you prefer to take that on, your term is interbeing. Emptiness would be the more traditional Buddhist phrase, but yeah, it's our Mother Teresa says, if we have no peace, it's because we forget we belong to each other, which is, you know, the same sentiment.
So this is an important concept. We have to get this into our head, kind of figure out that love is not having to say I'm sorry and whatever else we might have thought about. It's not the thing that on the Valentine's Day card. So now we come back and sort of what role does this play in a criminal justice system where the assumption of our system is the suffering is caused by a perpetrator who did something. Everybody was fine. The order was good. Then a crime was committed and a victim suffered owing to an offender's bad judgment and bad mistake. That's the assumption we make. Where does love play any part in that? And why is suffering a part of that? Suffering was caused by crime.
Yeah, that's true. But also suffering was the cause of crime. You know, hurt people at bottom. And it's an expression of crime is an expression of suffering. And in every case, and we have to be very careful about generalities. But I'm not in this regard. I believe that all harms are traceable to previous harms. And so or misunderstandings. You know, we learn from Buddhist wisdom, greed, aversion and ignorance are the sources of
greed, aversion, and ignorance.
Right. So, fear. In fact, what's nice about this idea, I think, in terms of, and you know, I remember in grad school talking to my criminology professor, and I said, you know, all these theories that they've laid out in terms of explaining crime, the criminal ideological theories, they fall short in the sense that they treat crime as if it's a reified, separate type of thing. Crime is like cheesecake. Nothing else in the world is like cheesecake, you know. Nothing else holds cherries like cheesecake. So you have, you know, this phenomenon of it being kind of a separate, reified thing in terms of how we theorize, and that doesn't make any real sense. And so it has to be whatever theories we use really must recognize that crime is a behavior, a natural human process, you know. And so this idea about examining crime from a perspective of suffering, you know, hurt people, explains not just crime, but all kinds of things like racism, like bad driving, like crappy parenting, like, you know, all these harmful behaviors that, you know, we don't just think of this in terms of the process of crime, which, of course, is itself is, you know, what is a crime in terms of its anatomical makeup? It's, you know, a behavior that's been detected that has been proscribed previously at law, right? All of those things have to be in place for something to be a crime. That's a useless definition for us in terms of understanding my obligation to you, Frank, as a human being. My accountability to you is not predicated on this kind of strange definition of right and wrong, but in terms of my our fundamental connected humanness, which itself then is even better thought of as founded on our common divinity.
And if that is all true, if there's something bigger than all of us that binds all of us, then your analogy of a criminal justice system that looks at crime as something fundamentally other, then the tendency, as you write, is to treat the people who have broken the law as fundamentally other. They instantly become dehumanized.
Well, we punish it. We actually punish for ourselves. I think when we punish as an indulgence to help us reaffirm our sense of community, our own proper conduct and our own membership. And of course, that has the consequences of, you know, treating others as means to an end, which, of course, is in itself fundamentally unethical. But it's also, you know, deepening confusion about what matters, the idea that, you know, we're re-identifying ourselves as separate beings. We're creating this bright line distinction between ourselves and everybody else, which is also a lie, you know. The real truth is in connection.
So when you look at that, then what is you also took a look at the criminal justice system itself, again, designed to protect us all from harm. You're saying it's not working. I mean, what's your analysis?
Well, the analysis, I think, you know, kind of writes itself. I mean, certainly, you know, with protests in town and here in Durham and elsewhere, I spent time October, November in Ferguson with some folks there. Clearly, the problems with, you know, that we've seen with police portray that for us. But, you know, beyond that, think about there's just the simple concept of a million-dollar block. Have you been familiar with this, the idea of the million-dollar block? Basically, the idea is that you can have a city block where people have been incarcerated from that city block at a cost to the taxpayers of that state to the tune of $1 million or more, right? So, mass incarceration bleaches the community of its resources. When family members, brothers, sons, fathers, uncles, and mothers, daughters, cousins are removed from the home, that's a diminished capacity for the home for the children that are there, right?
But look, here's the thing that someone will say about that million-dollar block. Bad things happen in that neighborhood, really bad things. And I'm not going to go in there when a bad thing happens and wrap my arms around the perpetrator and say, you and I are one, and then find that I'm not going home to dinner that night, Michael.
Right. Well, let's also point out that 16 states, I saw recently that 16 states have more prison beds than college university seats. So, you know, that raises some questions about, you know, how we would actually about our priorities. I mean, that's an important point about the risks that we take. But risks we ask police officers to take, for example, we ask them to take risks in an incomplete way. We want them to use force to draw that line for us when, in fact, what we need are, you know, fewer lines, fewer divisions. And, in fact, the risks that we have to take are not theirs, but in fact ours. Now, they have risks too. There's a classic bit police talk about the idea of job one is to go home. This is a problematic idea, in my opinion. That doesn't mean that officers' lives are cheap. Far from it, of course. But, you know, if you look at the oaths police officers take, it isn't I promise to go home. It's I promise to preserve life. Preserving life is job one, and that means including the life of the offender. Now, that may come at a cost on occasion. It may come at a horrendous cost, and we have to honor that. But that doesn't change the fundamental, you know, reality of that dynamic. And of course, then there's a desire later on after those kinds of things happen. We grieve for a loss of an officer, but the thought of responding to that by shoring up the possibility of risk is just simply inauthentic and dysfunctional.
But you also point out in the book that we, and I think you say fourth, love me, here I'm quoting for the book, fourth, Love means co-bearing risks and burdens. The idea that we too have a responsibility, which we all, we good law-abiding citizens who go home to our safe homes every day and consume the way we consume and watch media the way we watch media and in one way or another are complicit in creating the inequities, the inequalities, and the disparities in this economy, even if we aren't prepared to admit it, that our behavior makes these grindingly poor neighborhoods over there, and then in the safety of our own home, ask that police officer to go into that neighborhood that I've helped create by my consumption patterns and risk his or her life to keep me safe. That's me not co-bearing my responsibility for their very difficult job.
That's exactly right. And of course, we have to undo a lot of this stuff. But one thing that we one other step here is this idea that, you know, historically speaking, policing, that's only an expedient. It's a mechanism. It's a device. You know, real policing is something that we give to each other. It's a mutual accountability that we offer, and we can't forget the fact that the institution of police, the police officers we set up, are empowered and trained tool, but it is our responsibility to come from us first.
So that gets back to this notion of love. Then if you rolled your eyes at the beginning of this conversation thinking, how are we going to love criminals back into compliance? Well, that would be a problem if all we do is ask police officers to wrap their arms around people. But what you're saying is each of us has to then bear the burden and understand each other and then participate in a much larger act of love, act of self-giving, and not just put it all on them and say, hey, I'd like you to change your point of view, change your approach.
That's
what you're saying. So, and there have been ways. And then there come to be methods. Well, how do I do this? I mean, this is a huge culture. There's a mythology about every institution that it tells its own story and it reinforces that story. And I know that in some departments they've used mindfulness classes. They've helped officers and whole departments kind of understand their job and themselves in a new way. This recent On Being program, it's a public radio program hosted by Krista Tippett. She talked with Officer Sherry Maples, who was with the Madison Police Department in Wisconsin. She had taken some mindfulness classes given by the Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh. And she, you know, thought it was a good idea, but then thought about it, you know, in terms of herself as a police officer and, you know, was pretty skeptical.
I just assumed, well, I'd listen to this, but I can't do it. I'm a cop, you know. I mean, I might be in a position where I have to kill somebody at some point. I can't think about taking these.
And then she told this story.
I was on a domestic violence call, and it was one of these calls where I would have just arrested the guy. I would have just, hey, enough's enough, you know. This was a scenario where breaking up is hard to do, and there was a little girl, and they were exchanging custody, and he was kind of holding the little girl hostage, not wanting to give her back to mom. And there had been no violence that had taken place, but both mom and the little girl were very scared and intimidated. And ordinarily, I would have said, that's it. Slap the handcuffs on him, taking him to jail. But something stopped me. And it was, I had just come out of this retreat, and I got the little girl, got him to give me the little girl, took care of her, got her and her mom set, told them just to leave, went back. And I just talked to this guy from my heart, and within 5 minutes, I mean, I've got this big gun belt on. I'm about 5'3", right? And this guy's like 6'6", and he's bawling, you know, and I'm holding this guy with this big gun belt on and everything. And he was just in incredible pain. And that's what I started realizing we deal with is misplaced anger because people are in incredible pain. So I ran into him 3 days later in a little store on Willie Street where I lived at the time, and this guy comes, he sees me off duty, picks me up, gives me this big bear hug, and says, you saved my life that night. Thank you.
It's Wisconsin police officer Sherry Maples on the program On Being, talking about some mindfulness training she took from Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh. How does that work then? I mean, as a practical matter, can you imagine a time in which or a place in which, you know, sort of police departments are taking this? You work with police officers. You work with police departments. When you talk to them about this, what do they say to you?
Well, it varies. Former chief of police, a friend of mine, tends to kind of politely roll his eyes. At the same time, you know, over the course of time, I began to hear him saying before his retirement things that we had discussed, you know, in his public addresses to people about the crime problem in town. Others are actually very receptive to the idea. And I think you recognize, when an officer recognizes she or he is is there for the best reasons, the most noble of reasons, there is a much greater receptivity to these ideas. We talked about the Wile E. Coyote problem, where we're sheepdogs, and the bad guys are wolves, and we have to protect the sheep. This is a toxic idea, but some officers will cling to this desperately because it is so sexy, but it is in fact a lie.
But they're reflecting a more general social idea that there's a class of subhuman called criminal,
right.
And then there's us good people,
right.
And then there's an even better class of superhuman who actually will stand between us and
right.
the subhuman criminals, and they will do the dirty work, and that's the binary that, as you say, doesn't really reflect the way things work.
No, and it doesn't. I mean, if you look at offending, it's there aren't differences. A lot of people will say, well, but look at the makeup of prisons. Who's in prison? These lower class, disproportionately minority. This is who's doing the offending. And of course, then you look at research and you say, well, no. Street crime, number one, of course, causes damage. It does cause it causes a lot of harm. But the amount of crime that's done by corporate actors and by state in terms of state crime, on balance, causes far more harm, many times as much harm. And in fact, in terms of self-report data, indications are that the people who are serving time aren't the people who are doing most of the offending, particularly people who look like me. I'm white, by the way, for clarity for our listeners. That's where the balance of the offending tends to happen. We tend to have faith in our institutions for a reason. At the same time, it's important for us to question that.
So now we've seen militarization of our prison systems, privatization, profit making from prison. So now it's getting complicated because there are people, whole corporations profiting by crime. So do they want to see the crime rate drop? I don't want to be a cynic about this. And the militarization of our police. To what extent does that all reinforce this? Make it more difficult to climb down?
Well, the funny thing about the militarization of police, and we've been doing that for quite a long time. I mean, it caught wind with Michael Brown's slaying, but that wasn't that was more about a clumsy response than it was about militarization, the officers becoming confused about their role. I've talked to the chief of police in Ferguson is, if anything, he's a gentleman, maybe not fully prepared for the challenges that he's facing. And I the militarization things, it's hard for me, I think, to hang that as an issue because, of course, the ideas behind it about fear, as we've already talked about, are the things that tend to drive that idea as even a possibility.
It does. Forgive me for interrupting,
yeah.
But it does make it easier to reinforce this idea that there's bad guys out there and us good guys here.
Right.
And particularly if I can build a barrier, the stronger the barrier, then I can actually apply more force. I've got it. I'm protected. Force maybe instead of becoming the last option, might go up the agenda.
Well, officers are trained to kind of bring a gun to a knife fight. They're trained to be more prepared than their anticipated adversary. But again, where maybe Darren Wilson made his classic mistake was using force in one moment may have made some sense. Using force at the end after Michael had left the car simply didn't, because if the guy's walking away, you're no longer in danger. You have a radio and call backup. Just simply call backup.
Where do you think – I know that you've written a kind of a theoretical framework for a new way forward in criminal justice, so it's not necessarily a prescription for how we get there, but I'm not going to let you go without asking you that. Can we get there from here?
Well, the issue of contemplative practices is the process, is part of the process. And that's important because it puts it on each of us. Knowledge of mind is something that we have failed to do utterly in the West, and I mean that in fundamental terms. And it's where we must begin. So from there, the rest will tend to follow kind of attendantly, really. I mean, self-care, self-awareness, those are the things that have to begin, that are the point of departure for us in terms of building this justice system that we would want to be able to pass off to our kids. That's really the fundamental measure, I think. I have a daughter, and she's the muse for the work in the sense that I can't in good conscience be accountable to her for this mess.
Michael, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Michael DeValve, a criminal justice professor at Fayetteville State University. His new book is called A Different Justice, Love and the Future of Criminal Justice in America. Stay tuned. There's more of the State of Things just ahead.